Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Nebraska by Brad Dennison, narrated by J. Rodney Turner. Part 1. The Trail. 1. Abe had said the land would flatten out once they were beyond the Missouri, and it surely did. But not entirely flat, Jerry Moretti had noticed. It looked flat from a distance, but up close he saw it was really an endless series of long, low hills that stretched sometimes for half a mile, and those hills were covered with grass that the wind made ripple like it was all a great, grassy ocean. Jerry was on the back of a horse, with a rifle in his saddle, and he rode to the top of one of the low hills. From the top of the hill, he could see what he figured was 3, maybe 4 miles in any direction. Hard to tell out here. Maybe he would grow accustomed to it. But he and the wagon train had left Missouri not quite 2 weeks ago, and he still found the distance a little deceptive. When Jerry had left New York for Tennessee, he had never been on the back of a horse. But he was spending more hours in the saddle than not since leaving Tennessee, and he felt he was turning into a reasonably good horseman. Not like Jeff, who rode like he and the horse were one. Jeff was a seasoned cavalryman. But Jerry no longer bounced in the saddle as he rode. His backside was no longer bruised feeling at the end of the day. Jerry's hair was dark, and it had grown out since he had left New York. It was now sprouted from under his hat like a juniper bush that wanted to engulf the collar of his jacket. He had worn a cloth cap when he left New York, but a few weeks ago he had replaced it with a wide-brimmed felt hat. He had visited the general store in Missouri, and a farmer had bought a new hat and left his old one to be discarded. Jerry had said to the storekeeper, "How much you want for that old hat?" The man was thin, with suspenders over the shoulders of his white shirt. He shrugged those shoulders. "I was just gonna throw it out. Take it." Then so, Jerry had himself a new hat, and he found the size to be about right. It would have been a little big for him, but now that his bushy hair was growing longer, he found that the hat fit well. As he sat in the saddle at the crest of the low hill, he saw what he had been hoping to see. A buck sauntered up the slope of another low hill, maybe a quarter mile away. It stopped partway up the slope, and then lowered its head and pushed its nose into the grass. Jerry had learned to track an animal. Something he never thought he would need back on the docks of Brooklyn, and he had been following the trail of this buck for an hour. Deer usually traveled in groups, he had learned, a buck and a small harem of does. But this buck was alone, at an 8-point rack, and he would feed the boys and Molly and Aunt Doty nicely tonight. Aunt Doty's name was Dorothy Monroe, and Jerry and the others had called her Mrs. Monroe. But she said, "I want none of that. Molly calls me Aunt Doty, and you all should, too." A Sharps rifle was tucked into his saddle boot, and he slid the gun free. When he had left Tennessee, he had a revolver but no rifle. In Missouri, he had visited the local gunsmith in pursuit of a rifle. At first, he had wanted a repeater, and a used Henry stood in the rack. "Holds 15 rounds," the man behind the counter had said. 16 if you have one in the chamber. But a Sharps stood beside it. A single-shot 52 caliber, but the man had said it had a lot more range than a Henry. "Where you're heading, out onto the grassland of Nebraska territory, a Sharps might be more what you need. A Henry allows you to fire fast, and it's good and accurate for about 200 yards. But a Sharps is accurate for 1,000 yards. Jerry talked to Jeff about it that night, and the following morning he rode back into town to buy the Sharps. A small stand of bushes waited a few yards away, so he touched the heels of his boots to his horse and rode on over. He swung out of the saddle and left the horse hitched to a strong-looking branch. Plenty of green springtime grass for the horse to feast on while Jerry went after that buck. The wind was blowing toward Jerry, which meant the buck couldn't catch his scent. Also, meant the animal might not hear the metallic click as Jerry cocked his rifle. But he had to be careful, he knew. Even though the deer couldn't catch his scent, it could still maybe hear him if he wasn't careful. He got down on all fours, with the rifle in one hand, and he began to crawl slowly toward the deer. He glanced back at his horse, and the animal was looking at him like he thought he was crazy. That was because the poor horse would never understand the taste of deer meat, Jerry figured, and the horse was surely missing out. Jerry couldn't imagine grass or oats worth crawling on your hands and knees for. The grass under his hands and knees was wet in places. The sun had risen only 3 hours before and not yet burned off all of the dampness of the night before. Even though it was still spring and the nights a little chilly, the morning sun felt warm on his back. Crawling on your hands and knees was a slow way to travel, but the buck didn't look like he was in much of a hurry. These last few months in Tennessee and Missouri had given Jerry some experience hunting, and he had learned that patience was the greatest virtue. He placed a hand down on a damp patch of grass. A small stick was there, maybe blown in the wind or washed over from some bushes during the last rain. The stick was damp, but it made a small snapping sound anyway, under the weight of Jerry's hand. The buck lifted its head and looked in Jerry's direction. Jerry froze in position, not batting an eye. A deer's eyesight was limited, but it would be able to see motion, so Jerry held still. After a few moments, the buck went back to grazing, and Jerry resumed crawling his way forward. When he was about 500 feet away, he stopped moving. He waited a moment, then sat up. The deer continued grazing. Jerry figured he was close enough now to easily make the shot. Growing up in New York, he had never fired a rifle, but he had gotten fairly good at it in recent months. He brought the rifle stock to his shoulder and then sighted it on the deer. And then he slowly cocked the hammer. Even slowly, there was a little click of metal on metal, and the buck looked up. But the buck was in Jerry's sights, and Jerry aimed at a place just behind the shoulder and squeezed the trigger. And yet, something caught the buck's attention, and the animal turned and took a quick step as Jerry squeezed the trigger. The sharps recoiled against his shoulder, and a cloud of gun smoke whirled about him for a moment. Black powder produced a lot of smoke, and then the breeze dissipated the smoke, and Jerry could see the buck sprinting off over the crest of the low, grassy hill, and he was gone. Jerry set the rifle down in the grass and cursed his luck. What could have possibly gotten the buck's attention and caused him to turn at the last second? Then he saw it. Movement. At least one low, rising hill away. Possibly two hills. He was still learning to gauge distance out here. He rose up onto one knee and focused his gaze on the motion. They were tiny in the distance, but he could tell they weren't deer. They were horses. More accurately, they were riders. Maybe six of them. Among the settlers, there was a spyglass. It belonged to Ezra Winkle, and in the 2 weeks since they had crossed the Missouri River, both Jeff Boone and Abe Hackett had taken turns borrowing it. Jerry wished he had the spyglass now. He would like to have seen close up who those riders were. One thing he was sure of, they weren't from the wagon train. Jerry held still. He didn't want to draw their attention. It was bad enough that he had fired at the deer, and there was no way they could have missed hearing his gunshot. They knew he was out here. He remained on one knee, not moving. He knew the human eye was attracted to motion. His rifle was on the ground beside him, and the persistent breeze out here in the grasslands made the brim of his hat shake a little. But he held still so he wouldn't draw their eye, and he waited, watching as the riders climbed the low, rounded crest of the flattened-out, grassy hill. They weren't coming closer, but were following a parallel direction. Could they be Indians? Maybe. Jerry didn't know enough about this land to make that determination. He watched as they reined up and looked about, maybe looking for the source of that gunshot. Then they continued on, heading south and down the long, low slope of the hill. After a time, they were gone from his sight. Jerry had listened as Abe talked about this land. Indians often rode horses that were not shod, but there were also renegades out here that sometimes had horses that were shod and sometimes not. He grabbed his rifle and opened the action of his rifle and tossed away the empty cartridge. Then he pushed in a fresh one and snapped the action shut. Then he drew his revolver and checked the loads. He had seen Jeff do that and often wondered why, but now he understood. He wanted to make sure his gun was loaded properly should he need it. He rose to his feet and didn't quite run, but walked dang fast back to his horse. Then he rode toward that hill the riders had crossed. He wanted to check those tracks. The sod out in these grasslands was thick and didn't hold a track like bare earth would. But when he looked at those tracks, he figured at least one of the horses had been shod. Maybe two. He decided it was time to head back to the wagons, report to Jeff what he had seen, and maybe he and Jeff would confer with Abe. Not that Jerry was comfortable dealing with Abe. Jeff wasn't either. But Abe had knowledge of the way of things out here on the grasslands. Knowledge that a Brooklyn boy like Jerry would not have. And neither would a Tennessee boy like Jeff. He glanced toward the sky. Dark clouds covered the northwestern horizon, and they looked to be coming in fast. When Jerry had first spotted the deer, there hadn't been a cloud in the sky. Could be a storm coming. Abe Hackett had said storms can come hard and fast on the open grasslands, and Jerry was at least a mile from the wagons. Looked like his scouting and hunting was done for the day. He slid his rifle back into the saddle boot and turned his horse back toward the wagons. As he rode, he could see lightning flashing from the dark clouds. He was what he guessed to be a mile from the trail when the clouds had grown to cover much of the sky, and hail came crashing down. Small at first, each one the size of a pea. He pulled his hat down tighter and hunched his shoulders against the hail. He glanced about, even though he knew there was no shelter out here. No tree to get under. He and the horse would just have to weather the storm. And then the hail increased. One nearly the size of a chicken egg struck a forearm, and others began bouncing against the horse's neck and back. The horse reared up, and Jerry went over backwards. Jeff might have been able to remain in the saddle, but Jerry landed hard in the grass on his left shoulder, his feet flipping up and over, and he came to a stop lying on his stomach with the hail bouncing around him and against him. And then it was over, almost as soon as it had started. Didn't last much more than a minute, he figured. The grass was now covered with thousands of little hail balls. He got to his knees for a look around. His horse was nowhere in sight. And gone with the horse was his rifle. He looked off toward the northwest, where the storm had seemed to come from. He saw a swath of what looked like fog between the clouds and the ground, and he knew that to be a hard rain. It was coming fast, and he had a mile between him and the trail. He pushed to his feet and started walking. 2. Jeff Boone had been riding ahead, scouting the land that he found so different from what he had grown up in. Tennessee had some flat country, and much of it had been cleared early on for farming and to provide building material and firewood. But there were also hills that were wooded. Nothing like these flat, stretched-out grassy rises. He had seen flat, open country like this in Texas during the war, so he was no stranger to it. But he found he had his fill of it during the war, and when he had first returned to Tennessee, he never thought he would be back in country like this. An hour earlier, he had noticed the dark clouds forming on the horizon. He knew the clouds were still miles away, but he also knew they meant a storm was coming. In open country, it didn't rain nearly as often as it did back home, but when the rain did come, it came in bucketfuls. He turned old Brown and rode back to the wagons. The first wagon in line this morning had a team of oxen that was being driven by Jimmy Wilson. Though, after being on the trail a couple of weeks, the oxen were growing accustomed to the daily routine and didn't need a whole lot of urging to keep up the pace. Jimmy glanced at Jeff and then turned away. Still a lot of hard feelings between them. Jimmy wore a dark hat with a brim that was blown up and flat against his forehead because of the constant wind. suspenders pulled against strong shoulders, and he wore dark homespun pants and boots that laced up the front. For the first few days after they had crossed the Missouri, Jimmy had carried a scatter gun in one hand as he urged the oxen along. After all, they were on the frontier, and he felt he needed to be ready should Indians attack. But after a few days, he had realized that life out here was more about hard work than adventure, and the scatter gun was now in the wagon. Mary Stevens walked beside him. A bonnet was tied about her neck and had fallen back against her shoulders. Her hair was tied into a bun, but loose strands caught the wind and danced about her face. A face Jeff had seen in his dreams many a time during the war. But now her attention was focused on Jimmy, and his heart was being captured more and more every day by a girl named Molly. Next wagon back was Abe Hackett, walking along beside another team of oxen, and Mary's mother was walking with him. Abe wore his twin revolvers at his hips. Always armed, he was. Abe didn't start the morning fire and fix coffee without first buckling on his guns. He had been that way when they had left Tennessee for Missouri, and he was that way now. Abe looked up at Jeff. Jeff reined up. Got us a storm coming. Abe nodded his head. Seen the clouds. Gonna rain hard. And by the looks of them clouds, there's more coming behind them. I'm thinking we ain't gonna get much more distance today. I think we should stop soon, get the wagon circled and get the stock inside. Get the tent set up. Could be a wet, cold night. Even though Jimmy Wilson was accepted as their leader, it turned out to be Abe and Jeff making most of the decisions. He and Abe had agreed to leave their differences behind until they reached Oregon. So far, they had managed to abide by their word. But when they talked, it was about matters relating to the wagon train only. No small talk, no chatting. Jeff said, "Why don't you have Jimmy give the word? I have Jerry and Robbie out scouting. They'll be back soon, and I'll tell them to get ready for a long, rainy night." He continued riding along. At the end of the short line of wagons was the one that belonged to Jeff, Pa, and Robbie, and the one after that belonged to the Monroe women. Pa was leading the oxen that pulled one wagon, and Molly was tending to the other. She could handle a team of oxen as well as Pa, and better than some of the men in this group of settlers. Jeff swung out of the saddle. He thought about tethering old Brown to the back of the wagon, but he decided against it. Brown wouldn't run off. Jeff went up to walk beside Molly, and Brown just followed along. The horse would stop to graze for a few minutes at a choice chunk of grass, and then he would trot ahead to catch up with the wagons. Jeff said to Molly, "Why don't you let me do that for a while? Kind of bothers me to see you driving the team when it should be me doing it." She gave him a grin. "Bothers your chivalrous pride, does it?" He shrugged his shoulders. "Well, yeah, a little. I wouldn't worry about it. These oxen pretty much drive themselves." She stepped away from them and Jeff took her hand. "I expect Jimmy is going to give the order for us to stop soon. We got a storm coming in." "I've been watching those clouds." Jeff nodded his head. "They're coming right at us." In the distance, a little streak of light danced from the clouds to the land below. Molly said, "Was that lightning?" "Yep. Out here you can see so far into the distance that you can see lightning long before you hear the thunder. Sometimes you don't even hear the thunder at all." Jeff could see the first couple of wagons turning away from the trail. They moved a couple of hundred feet to one side, and then the oxen were brought to a stop. The other wagons followed them. The wagons were placed in a rough circle, and the men went about tying rope from one wagon to the other to form a corral, with the oxen and horses inside the corral. Pa tied a section of rope onto a hook screwed into the side of his own wagon. He heard a clap of thunder and looked up at clouds nearly the color of charcoal that were now overhead. "That storm's coming fast." Jeff was tying the other end to the Monroe wagon. "We got to get the tent set up for the women. We can bunk in the wagons if we have to." That was when the hail started. Small at first, each ice stone the size of a pea, Get under the wagon, Jeff called out. Pa ducked and crawled under his wagon. Eb and Vince climbed under with him. Molly and her Aunt Doty found some difficulty in their long skirts crawling under their wagon, but Jeff assisted, giving each a gentle push, and then crawling under behind them. It was as he was crawling under that the size of Hale increased to maybe 3 inches across. One hit his right ankle, and he did a foolish thing, stopping and flinching with pain, and another hit him, easily the size of a goose egg. He pulled his leg under and rubbed at it. The first ice ball had hit the side of his ankle, where the bone sticks out and there's little meat for padding. That was the one that hurt. The second one hit his right shoulder, but it caught more muscle than bone. He could see Hank Bradford and his wife Edna climbing into the back of their wagon. Hank had one hand up to deflect hail from his head, while with the other he pushed his wife up and into the wagon. Jeff called out to them that they should get under the wagon, but they couldn't hear. Hail is loud, coming down with the sound of a rushing river. The oxen were now in the jerry-rigged corral, but they weren't taking kindly to the egg-sized hail bouncing against their hide. One of them turned and charged at a gap between two wagons, a gap that was barred with only two lines of rope. Ezra Winkle was there, trying to crawl under his own wagon, when the oxen exploded through the gap, catching the rope and rocking the two wagons the rope was tied to, and one hoof landed on Ezra's shin bone. He lurched upward, and Jeff heard his cry despite the roaring of the hail. Two other oxen decided to follow the first. One line of rope came free, or snapped. Jeff couldn't tell which, from where he crouched on all fours under the wagon. The other line held fast, and one wagon shook hard, and the other went over sideways. That wagon belonged to the Bickens family. Herb and his wife had three children, and all three had climbed into the wagon at the first sign of hail. And now the wagon was pitching over with them in it. Then the hail began to ease off. Jeff climbed out from under the wagon and looked at Molly. Stay here, both of you. He found his ankle hurt, but he could run along at a hobbling pace, and he went to Ezra. Jeff found him sitting up, gripping his leg with both hands. Pa joined them, along with Vince and Eb. Vince, Jeff said. Eb, check on the Pickens family. Pa said to Ezra, let me have a look. His wife Mildred knelt beside him. Oh, Ezra, are you hurt bad? She was from Scotland, and even though she had lived in Tennessee for years, she still had a hint of the old country in her speech. Pa prodded about Ezra's shin bone, and Ezra let out another shriek. Pa looked at Jeff. His leg's broke. That shin bone is almost in two pieces. Abe came walking over. Jeff said to him, how are you all? Abe nodded his head. We got through it, but we lost some livestock. Jimmy and I didn't get the lines tied in time, and his oxen and the Stevens team went a-running. Not much you can do to stop an ox once it's running. On a good day, the wind here on the grasslands was strong enough to knock the hat from a man's head, if the hat wasn't pulled on tight enough. But now it was picking up even more. Jeff said, we got rain coming. Abe nodded his head. Jeff looked up at Molly, who had followed him even though he had told her to stay under the wagon. We've got to get the tent set up now before the rain hits. Molly said, it's going to be a long night. Jeff nodded his head. One thing he liked about this woman was that she saw the way of things, but she didn't complain. She went to work with him, setting up the tent, as the wind blew and shook the canvas of the tent and the covers of the wagons. And then the rain came down. Hard and cold. 3. Molly sat in a wooden chair in the tent. We're not going to get a fire going tonight, at least not until the rain stops. Aunt Doty came in with Pa. His hat was dripping with rainwater, and his shirt was soaked. She had grabbed the blanket and wrapped it about her shoulders, but now the blanket was wet. Pa said, funny how we tried to think of everything before we left Missouri. A camp stove would have been good. We could cook even in the rain, as long as we could get even a small fire started. You all stay in here. I'm going to go check on Ezra, Jeff said. He had pulled the slicker from his saddlebags, and he draped it over his shoulders and stepped out into the rain. Evan Vince had gotten the Winkles' tent set up just before the rain hit. Jeff found Abe had broken two broom handles and made a makeshift splint for Ezra with two broken pieces of the handle on one side of the leg and two at the other, and he tied them all together with strips of bedsheet. Abe shook his head. A right poor splint, but it'll have to do. Mildred Winkle looked at him with dread in her eyes. Where can we go to get a doctor out here? In the middle of nowhere. Abe rubbed at his chin and then glanced over at Jeff. Things ain't quite the way they were the last time across the wagon trail, when I was coming east all them years ago. Back then there was nothing but hundreds of miles of empty land between the Missouri and Fort Laramie. But now a few towns have sprung up. Jeff said, What's the nearest one? From what they told me back in Missouri, there are two towns along the Platte River, Fremont and Columbia, and one of them is bound to have a doctor. He must be about 40 miles southwest of them as the crow flies. We can get there by following the trail and then cutting east where the trail joins the main overland trail, but that'll take a lot longer. He shook his head. Ain't to go that way. We'll be backtracking. The plan was to join up with the Platte about 10 miles west of those towns. I don't see as we have much of a choice. No, don't seem like we do. Mildred said, How long will it take us to get to one of those towns? Abe drew a breath, like a man who has to deliver some bad news and didn't relish it. We've been making 10 miles a day, maybe 12. Got good weather so far, but we've been following a wagon trail. He looked at Jeff. To get to Columbia or Fremont the short way, we're going to have to go overland, and it won't be easy going. I doubt we'll make 8 miles a day. Ezra was on a cot, sitting up as much as his leg would allow. We could send a rider. Abe shook his head. A rider could make that ride in 2 days, maybe a day and a half, but he'll have to bring a doctor back here, and we'll still have to get you to the town. Why's that? Just have the doc treat my leg right here. Abe let out a sigh, and he looked at Jeff again. Jeff said, Your leg is broken bad, Ezra. Abe shook his head. You ain't going to be able to continue on with us. Your leg wouldn't be able to handle the trail, and we can't wait for you. He's right. I've seen wounds like this in the war. Bad as this and some even worse. It'll be at least 3 weeks before your leg's healed enough to be able to handle the jostling you'll get riding in a wagon on the trail. And you won't be able to work your way along on crutches for at least that long. It would just be too much. We can't wait 3 weeks. It's bad enough that we're going to lose the time we're going to lose getting to Fremont or Columbia. Probably a full week. We got to get through the mountains before the first snow, and the first snow hits mighty early in them mountains. We're going to lose more time than that. We've got to round up some oxen before we can even begin the journey to those towns. Abe shook his head. This ain't good. Ain't good at all. Ezra looked from Abe to Jeff. I can't believe you're going to just leave us behind. Jeff said, We're not going to just leave you, Ezra. Get out of here, both of you. Jeff glanced at Mildred. She looked at him with sad eyes, but Jeff didn't know if it was because her husband was embarrassing her, or she was concerned about his broken leg and the pain he was in, or if she was sad about the thought of being left in a strange town. Jeff gave a little apologetic shrug of his shoulders and stepped back out into the rain. The hour seemed much later than it was because the clouds overhead were so dark. It was probably not much later than early afternoon, Jeff figured. He walked toward the Monroe tent but saw a man walking out beyond it. The rain wasn't quite a downpour anymore, but was strong enough that he couldn't see clearly who it was. But he could tell the man was leading a horse behind him. Jeff walked beyond the tent to meet the man, and he saw it was Robbie. It's raining hard out there, Robbie said. I saw a twister drop down when the clouds were still a ways off. It was there for only a few seconds, but I figured I'd better get back to camp. Then the rain hit, and my horse slipped in the wet grass, and I think he hurt a leg. Jeff shook his head. Are you all right? soaked and chilled to the bone. Nothing a good hot fire and some dry clothes won't cure. Won't be any.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?